In our previous lecture, we looked at the Supreme Court's rulings in cases that involved two very controversial issues, school prayer and abortion. The justices had issued landmark rulings in these areas of law in the 1960s and 70s, striking down religious exercises in public schools and state laws that imposed criminal penalties on abortions. Efforts to reverse these decisions by amending the Constitution have come close to passage in Congress on several occasions, but they failed to gain the necessary two-thirds majority in both houses of Congress. However, the school prayer and abortion issues have returned to the court in dozens of cases over the past three decades. As we've seen, the justices have stood firmly behind their school prayer rulings, striking down prayers at graduation ceremonies and high school football games. But the court has upheld laws that withhold public funding of abortion and that limit access to abortion in various ways. We also saw in previous lectures that Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Bush named five justices between 1981 and 1991, moving the court to the right and setting the stage for the possible reversal of the Roe decision. In this lecture, we'll look first at the showdown over abortion in 1992. And we'll examine the opinions that exposed the deep split in the court over this issue. We'll also discuss the court's ruling in the year 2000 on the emotional question of partial birth abortions. Finally, we'll turn to another controversial ruling in 2000, in which the court decided the outcome of the presidential election between Texas Governor George W. Bush and Vice President Al Gore. This case also created sharp divisions among the justices over the power of state courts to decide election contests. We're going to look first at the abortion case of Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey in 1992. As background to this case, we saw in our previous lecture that the court had been urged in 1989, in the Webster case from Missouri, to reverse the Roe decision. Four conservative justices were clearly eager to overturn Roe, but Justice Sandra O'Connor argued that Webster was not the proper case to make that decision. 3 years later, after the retirements of Justices William Brennan and Thurgood Marshall, there seemed to be a clear majority to reverse the Roe decision. The two new justices, David Souter and Clarence Thomas, had declined to give their views on abortion at their confirmation hearings, but most observers felt they would vote to overturn Roe. The Casey case involved several restrictions that Pennsylvania lawmakers had placed on access to abortions. The law required doctors to explain the risks of abortion to pregnant women and to provide them with state-approved information about alternatives to abortion, such as adoption. It also required women seeking abortions to sign a written consent and then to wait 24 hours for an abortion after signing the form. A coalition of abortion providers had sued Pennsylvania's governor, Robert Casey, to block the law, but lower federal courts had upheld the challenge provisions. The pro-choice groups that backed the challenge to the Pennsylvania law had rushed to file their appeal before the Supreme Court's term ended in June of 1992. They expected the conservative majority to reverse the Roe decision, and they wanted to make abortion an issue in the 1992 congressional and presidential campaigns. Public opinion polls showed a pro-choice majority among the electorate, when voters would presumably support candidates who pledged to protect abortion rights. In this political scenario, the Supreme Court would become their target, with future nominations to the court at stake in campaigns for the Senate and the White House. So politics were on everyone's mind when the arguments began on April 22nd of 1992. Catherine Colbert spoke for Planned Parenthood. She challenged the justices to either flatly reverse the Roe decision or to firmly uphold it and to end the uncertainty about abortion rights. She put her argument in these words: "Never before has this court bestowed and taken back a fundamental right that has been part of the settled rights and expectations of millions of Americans for nearly two decades. Taking back those rights," she added, "would be incompatible with any notion of principled constitutional decision-making." Pennsylvania's Attorney General, Ernest Preet, replied that the court should apply the Webster case as precedent and uphold the state's law short of overruling Roe, as he put it. But if the two cases could not be reconciled, Preet said, Roe, being wrongly decided, should be overruled. As the court's term neared its end, and the public waited for its decision in this case, an interesting article appeared on the front page of the New York Times under the headline, Changed Path for the Court, New Balances Held by Three Cautious Justices. Linda Greenhouse, who covered the court for the Times, wrote that effective control of the court has passed to a subgroup of the majority, a moderately conservative middle group of three justices. Pictured next to her article were Justices Sandra O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, and David Souter. The group's hallmarks, Greenhouse wrote, appear to be a generally cautious approach to deciding cases, a hesitancy to overturn precedents, and a distaste for aggressive arguments. This group does not always vote together, but when it does, its views prevail. Linda Greenhouse proved to be an accurate prophet. 3 days after her article appeared, on June 29th of 1992, the court handed down its decision in Casey. In virtually every case, the court's ruling is expressed in an opinion that five or more justices have joined. But in this case, what was called the judgment of the court appeared under the name of just three justices, O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter. Their opinion began with these words, "Liberty finds no refuge in a jurisprudence of doubt." The justices in the court's middle explained their position in these words, "After considering the fundamental constitutional questions resolved by Roe, principles of institutional integrity, and the rule of stare decisis, we are led to conclude that the essential holding of Roe v. Wade should be retained and once again reaffirmed." Justices Harry Blackmun and John Paul Stevens joined this part of the centrist group's opinion, sparing Roe from reversal by a one-vote margin. Now, there were five separate opinions in this case, with overlapping groups of justices who joined parts of each one. But we're going to focus on the joint opinion of Justices O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter. In my view, the reasoning in their opinion provides much insight about the dilemma that faces justices whose personal values are in conflict with judicial precedent over difficult issues like abortion. We've already seen that Justice Kennedy faced such a conflict in the flag-burning case, and that he voted to protect an act he found personally abhorrent. Kennedy was reportedly the primary force behind the joint opinion in the Casey case, despite his personal objections to abortion. The most important and interesting aspect of the joint opinion is the reasons it offered for not reversing the Roe decision, despite what its authors called the personal reluctance any of us may have to affirm its central holding. The three justices frankly acknowledged the political factors that influenced their decision. In a fascinating history lecture, they discussed two landmark cases in which the court had overruled settled precedent, the cases of Plessy v. Ferguson and Adkins v. Children's Hospital, which we discussed in earlier lectures. Plessy had upheld segregation laws in 1896, and Adkins had struck down minimum wage laws for women in 1923. The court overturned Plessy in the Brown decision of 1954 and the Adkins case in the West Coast Hotel ruling of 1937. The three justices in Casey argued that changed circumstances had required the court to reverse those earlier rulings. They stressed, in their words, the terrible price that would have been paid if the court had not overruled Plessy and Adkins. That price would have been the erosion of the court's legitimacy in the public mind. And that legitimacy is a product, the three justices wrote, of the people's acceptance of the judiciary as fit to determine what the nation's law means and to declare what it demands. Now, how did this reasoning lead these justices to reaffirm the Roe decision rather than overrule it? They offered two reasons. First, as they wrote, an entire generation has come of age free to accept Roe's concept of liberty in defining the capacity of women to act in society and to make reproductive decisions. In other words, the court should not upset the settled expectations of women that they can obtain abortions. Secondly, the Roe decision involved what the three justices called an intensely divisive controversy. Overturning Roe, they suggested, would inflame rather than dampen the long-standing public debate over abortion. The three justices concluded, as they wrote, that to overrule under fire, in the absence of the most compelling reason to re-examine a watershed decision, would subvert the court's legitimacy beyond any serious question. Their opinion in Casey, they said, calls the contending sides of a national controversy to end their national division by accepting a common mandate rooted in the Constitution. Now, whether this argument for reaffirming the central holding of the Roe decision is persuasive is obviously a matter of opinion. It certainly did not persuade the four dissenters, Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justices Scalia, White, and Thomas. In his dissenting opinion, Scalia deplored what he called the outrageous arguments of his three colleagues. He directed particular scorn at the undue burden test that Justice O'Connor had adopted in abortion cases. O'Connor has applied this test to laws that place what she calls a substantial obstacle in the path of women seeking abortions. Scalia denounced the undue burden test as unprincipled in origin and hopelessly unworkable in practice. He said, the joint opinion's verbal shell game will conceal raw judicial policy choices about the decisions of elected lawmakers. Justice Scalia concluded his opinion with these scornful words, the imperial judiciary lives. We should get out of this area where we have no right to be and where we do neither ourselves nor the country any good by remaining. Now, one aspect of the Casey ruling was almost ignored in this judicial crossfire. The three centrist justices and the four conservatives agreed on all but one provision of the Pennsylvania law. These seven justices sustained the consent requirement, the 24-hour waiting period, and the requirement of parental consent for unmarried minors. They differed on the provision that required a married woman to notify her husband she was seeking an abortion, unless she faced physical danger from her spouse. The four conservatives supported this provision, but Justices Harry Blackmun and John Paul Stevens joined the three centrists to strike it down. 19 years after Justice Blackmun wrote the Roe opinion, he was relieved that it survived the most determined efforts to reverse it. He called the joint opinion of Justices O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter an act of personal courage and constitutional principle. But he also recognized that Roe had again survived by just one vote. Blackmun ended his opinion with a remarkable personal statement. I am 83 years old. I cannot remain on the court forever. And when I do step down, the confirmation process for my successor may well focus on the issue before us today. Blackmun also knew that abortion would become an issue in the presidential contest that was already underway between President George Bush and his Democratic challenger, Bill Clinton. The two candidates offered voters a clear choice on abortion. Bush favored a constitutional amendment to overturn the Roe decision, while Clinton was committed to protecting it from reversal. Clinton owed his victory in that election over President Bush in part to his stand on abortion rights, although most voters were more concerned with economic issues. Neither candidate said much about the Supreme Court until the week before the election, when Bush told voters that he and Clinton had a fundamental difference about what should happen on the Supreme Court. The president added that if voters wanted somebody on there to legislate with a liberal point of view, they should vote for his opponent. Public opinion polls showed that many women who normally voted Republican had supported Clinton because they feared that Bush would lead an assault on the Roe decision. Now, as we've seen, Clinton had his first chance to shape the court when Justice Byron White retired in June of 1993, and he named Ruth Bader Ginsburg as the second female justice. Clinton's second opportunity came a year later, when Justice Harry Blackmun left the court in June of 1994. With Ginsburg's confirmation, he felt assured that Roe would survive his departure. Although he served for 24 years and wrote more than 500 opinions, most people associate Blackmun with his Roe opinion in 1973. "I suppose I'll carry Roe to my grave," he once said. President Clinton named Stephen Breyer to replace Blackmun. Breyer was born in San Francisco in 1938 and graduated from Harvard Law School. He worked closely with Senator Edward Kennedy on issues like airline deregulation, and he taught administrative law at Harvard before Jimmy Carter placed him on the Federal Appellate Court in Boston in 1980, where he served briefly with Justice David Souter. Much like Justices Ginsburg and Souter, Breyer has become known as a cautious liberal on most issues, sticking to precedent wherever possible and writing careful, precise opinions that do not stake out any new constitutional ground. We're going to look now at a case in which Justice Breyer wrote an exceedingly precise opinion on the highly controversial issue of partial birth abortions. As we saw, three moderate justices had joined the court's two most liberal justices in 1992 to reaffirm what they called the central holding in the Roe decision. But the same three moderates had joined the four most conservative justices to uphold most of the restrictive provisions of the Pennsylvania law in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Those three justices, O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter, held the balance when the court decided the case of Stenberg versus Carhart in the year 2000. This case involved a Nebraska law that banned the procedure known as partial birth abortions. Now, there are two different methods of performing these late-term abortions. As Justice Breyer noted in his opinion, they strike most people as gruesome, but they require some description to understand the court's ruling in this case. It's important to note that both methods of partial birth abortions are rarely used in less than 1% of abortions. They're used most often when the fetus has a malformation, like hydrocephaly, when the head is swollen with fluid, and when live childbirth is impossible or would endanger the mother's life or health. The most commonly used partial birth method is known by doctors as dilation and evacuation, or D&E. Under this procedure, the fetus is dismembered with surgical instruments inside the uterus. Because the head is too large to pass through the cervix, the skull is pierced and the brain matter is sucked out. In some cases, however, doctors use another procedure known as dilation and extraction, or D&X. This abortion method involves what's called a breech delivery, in which the feet are first pulled out from the cervix and the skull is then pierced and drained to allow its removal from the uterus. The only difference is that D&X involves first pulling a body part through the cervix. Now, the reason we're getting into the details of these two procedures is that the difference between them became a central focus of the Supreme Court's opinion in the case of Stenberg versus Carhart. Nebraska was one of 30 states that passed laws to ban partial birth abortions. This law carried a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison and revocation of a doctor's license to practice in Nebraska. Dr. Leroy Carhart was the only doctor who performed late-term abortions in Nebraska. He sued the state's Attorney General, Don Stenberg, to block him from enforcing the law. The case reached the Supreme Court in 2000 after Nebraska lost the first two rounds in the lower federal courts. Justice Breyer wrote for a majority of five in striking down the Nebraska law. The justices were acutely conscious, he noted, of the virtually irreconcilable views that millions of Americans hold on the abortion issue. But he pointed to the Roe and Casey rulings, in which he said, "This court has determined and then redetermined that the Constitution offers basic protection to the woman's right to choose abortion. We shall not revisit those legal principles," Breyer stated firmly. "Rather, we apply them to the circumstances of this case." After he explained in graphic detail the abortion procedures known as D&X and D&E, Breyer faulted Nebraska lawmakers for writing their law so broadly that it could be read as banning both procedures, even though the state's lawyers claim They meant only to ban the DNX procedure. As we saw, the difference between the two is the DNX involves pulling a body part through the cervix rather than dismembering it inside the uterus. Justice Breyer concluded that the law was overbroad in subjecting doctors to prosecution for performing a lawful abortion procedure. He also faulted the law for not including an exception to protect the pregnant woman's health from the complications of pregnancy and childbirth. Breyer noted that both the Roe and Casey rulings had required states to provide health exceptions in their abortion laws. He put his conclusion in these words: "In sum, using this law, some prosecutors may choose to pursue physicians who use D&E procedures. All those who perform abortion procedures using that method must fear prosecution, conviction, and imprisonment. The result is an undue burden upon a woman's right to make an abortion decision." Now, it wasn't surprising that Chief Justice Rehnquist, along with Justices Scalia and Thomas, dissented in the Stenberg case. They had all dissented in Casey from its reaffirmation of the Roe decision. Scalia noted that Justice Breyer's clinical description of the partial birth abortion procedure, as he said, evokes a shudder of revulsion. He accused the majority of acting as legislators rather than as judges. "Those who believe that a 5-4 vote on a policy matter by unelected lawyers," Scalia argued, "should not overcome the judgment of 30 state legislatures, have a problem, not with the application of Casey, but with its existence. Casey must be overruled." It was surprising to some people, however, that Justice Kennedy joined the dissenters after his vote in Casey to reaffirm the Roe decision. He accused the majority of misinterpreting the Casey decision. But in my view, Kennedy's dissent in the Stenberg case reflected the personal and moral revulsion he shared with Scalia about the partial birth abortion procedure. He put his feelings in these words: "The decision nullifies a law expressing the will of the people of Nebraska that medical procedures must be governed by moral principles having their foundation in the intrinsic value of human life, including life of the unborn. It was not the fact of the abortions that Kennedy objected to in Stenberg, since doctors could use other methods in late-term abortions, some of them more risky than partial birth methods. It seems clear that it was the admittedly gruesome method which offended his moral views." Now, whether this should be a factor in deciding cases depends, in my view, on the moral perspective each person brings to this question. But it's worth noting that Justice Kennedy did not speak about the command of the Constitution in the partial birth abortion case as he had in the flag-burning case. These are both emotional issues for most people, but it's hard to separate moral and legal views when human life, or the potential for that life, is at stake. We'll turn now to the final case we'll examine in this course, the case of Bush versus Gore in December of 2000. We're not going to review all the details and disputes in this case. As most people recall, the outcome of that presidential election hinged on the 25 electoral votes in Florida. Whichever candidate received those disputed votes would become president. Millions of Americans watched on television at least part of the recount of disputed votes in several Florida counties. As the clock moved toward the final date for states to certify their electoral votes to Congress, the Florida Supreme Court ruled that election officials should continue their counting of disputed votes. The state judges based their decision on provisions of Florida's election laws. Lawyers for George Bush asked the U.S. Supreme Court to halt the recounts and to allow the Florida Secretary of State to certify the results that gave Bush the state's electoral votes. After the justices heard arguments in early December of 2000, the court granted Bush's motion and ordered the recounting to end. The legal issues in the case centered on two provisions of Article II in the Constitution. One provides that each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof shall direct, a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state might be entitled in the Congress. The other provision said that Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes. Congress had passed a law that set a date for states to cast their electoral votes. In this case, the date was December 18th. The Supreme Court also faced the question of whether state courts had the power to allow recounts to proceed until this final date. The justices handed down their ruling in Bush v. Gore on December 12th of 2000. The court issued an unsigned opinion that spoke for a majority of five justices, Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justices O'Connor, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas. These five justices based their ruling on the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. They noted that the Florida Supreme Court had not ordered election officials to adopt a uniform standard for deciding which ballots to count as legal votes for each presidential candidate. The five-justice majority put its concern in these words: "When a court orders a statewide remedy, there must be at least some assurance that the rudimentary requirements of equal treatment and fundamental fairness are satisfied." They held that it is obvious that the recount cannot be conducted in compliance with the requirements of equal protection before the time for submitting the electoral votes to Congress. Now, there are two aspects of this ruling that deserve mention. One is that these five justices, most notably Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Scalia, were not normally supportive of equal protection claims in most cases. The other is that all five were generally deferential to the decisions of state courts, especially when state judges were interpreting provisions of their own state laws and constitutions. Rehnquist and Scalia, in particular, advocate a notion of federalism that protects states from congressional regulation in many areas. But the five-justice majority in Bush v. Gore held that Florida's Supreme Court had erred in its reading of the state's election laws. The four dissenters in Bush v. Gore differed on the equal protection issue. Justices Souter and Breyer felt the Florida Supreme Court should decide on a uniform standard for counting votes and require election officials in each county to follow that standard. But the dissenters agreed that state officials should be given time to complete the recount before the deadline for casting electoral votes. Justice Stevens used the strongest words in his dissenting opinion. He wrote that Bush's appeal to the court rested on an unstated lack of confidence in the impartiality and capacity of the state judges who would make the critical decisions if the vote count were to proceed. And he added these words: "The endorsement of that position by the majority of this court can only lend credence to the most cynical appraisal of the work of judges throughout the land." Now, as we know, the court's ruling in Bush v. Gore effectively decided the outcome of the presidential election and put George W. Bush in the White House. The disappointed backers of Vice President Gore noted that all five justices in the majority had been named to the court by Republican presidents. All five, in fact, had been active in Republican politics before they joined the court. But this was not a simple partisan division. Justices Stevens and Souter were also nominated by Republican presidents, although neither had been active in party affairs. It's also true that Stevens and Souter were members of the court's liberal wing, along with Justices Ginsburg and Breyer, the other dissenters. So the judicial division in Bush v. Gore may reflect political ideologies more than partisan attachments. In any event, this case underscores the perceptive comment of Alexis de Tocqueville back in the 1830s. "Scarcely any political question arises in the United States," he wrote, "that is not resolved sooner or later into a judicial question." Now, we've seen in this lecture that two very political questions, abortion and presidential elections, became judicial questions in recent years. Virtually all the cases we've discussed in these lectures, in fact, began as political disputes and ended with judicial decisions. But in many cases, those rulings provoked more political debate and created more cases for the Supreme Court to decide. We'll look back on those cases and draw some conclusions about the links between law and politics in our concluding lecture.